Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, July 12th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Kara Santa Maria. And as always, before we dive into this week's show, I do want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible week after week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be, as long as I'm producing this little show, 100% free to download, and that is because of the support of wonderful people just like you. This week, I want to thank Mary Neva, Rob Schreck, Pasquale Gelati, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, June Sapara, Ulrika Hagman, and Robert Christ for their support of the show. If you would like to pledge on an episodic basis, even as little as a dollar, all you've got to do, oh, and also they allow you to do it in your own currency, so it doesn't have to be in American dollars. All you've got to do is visit patreon.com/talknerdy. And you can learn more. You can also find out everything you need to know at my website, carasantamaria.com, or at the show's website, talknerdy.com. All right, let's dive into this week's episode. It's a fascinating one. So I had the opportunity to sit down with author and historian of 20th century American fiction and culture, Audrey Claire Farley. Now, she has special interests in science and religion, and now she's a full-time writer, but she used to teach literature at the University of Maryland College Park, where she also got her PhD in English. Now, she's written for several outlets, but she shares with us her first book. It's called The Unfit Heiress, The Tragic Life and Scandalous Sterilization of Anne Cooper Hewitt. And of course, we're going to dive into it. There's so much even just in that title, but this is a story that you may or may not have heard. Very likely you haven't heard it. I hadn't heard it, about a 1930s millionaire heiress whose mother secretly sterilized her, A, to try and deprive her of the family fortune, but B, to really, it was really a marker of the time. You know, this was the early American eugenics movement. And so there's a lot to unpack with this one. It's a fascinating and horrifying story, and of course, an important one to not forget. So, without any further ado, here she is, Audrey Claire Farley. Well, Audrey, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So, I'm super excited to talk about your new book, The Unfit Heiress, The Tragic Life and Scandalous Sterilization of Anne Cooper Hewitt. And before we dive too deep into Anne's story, because I think that's where we'll be spending most of our time contextualizing her and her life, I was hoping that we could talk a little bit about you. So you are, I guess, an English PhD, and you work as a historian of fiction and culture. So what is a historian of fiction do? Like you study fiction, and is it really about the authors who wrote them? Is it about the context of when these stories were told? You know, where do you tend to kind of focus your scholarship?
Well, I trained as an English literature scholar, and I think that everyone who studies literature is a historian of sorts, because you are thinking about the culture in which books were produced, how they are engaging in the debates of their time, and, you know, their relevance in history. And so it was my background in literary studies that really encouraged my interest in 20th century America. And while I focused on fiction, I, you know, did a lot of work in just understanding the U.S. Over the course of the 20th century, which is how I came to this topic.
You know, it's interesting because, I don't know, maybe it's not that interesting, but as somebody who studies fiction, you ended up writing a nonfiction book that really is, you know, it's a deep history. It's a contextualization, like I mentioned. It's a criticism and a, I don't know, it really voices a lot of concerns about the treatment of time of women at the time. And so I'm wondering, as somebody who has studied English literature your whole life, was your intention and your hope to become a nonfiction writer?
No, that surprised me.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, part of my turning to this kind of work was, you know, I had graduated, I had left teaching in large part for personal reasons. My family moved back to our hometown and, you know, there are no academic jobs around here. And so it really wasn't my intent to write this book, but I had been doing a lot of reading about eugenics and I stumbled across Anne's story. And I was just so shocked that there had not already been a book or even a film about it. It was so interesting, just because of how sensational it was, but also because it was so historically significant, as I'm sure we'll talk about. And so, you know, I wasn't planning on writing this book. It just kind of happened to fall into my lap, and I knew I had to do it.
So let's dive in then. Let's talk about this important story that you told. And I think the hardest thing for me when I interview people who tell beautiful and important stories on the show is how do we have a conversation about the story without giving away too much of the book, right? But at the same time, this is a this is nonfiction. This is a historical story about a real person. And you can go online and you can try to piece things together, but of course, not at the level of scholarship that you were able to do with all of your deep research. So let's tell her story here in this space together, but at the same time, just, I guess, stop me or don't go there if you're like, no, you have to read the book because that part's so important.
Right. I'm okay with giving things away.
Okay. Good to know. I'm always so nervous about that. But I think that obviously it's not just going to be about Anne. It's going to be about the zeitgeist. And I think that's going to be an important conversation to be had. And also how it relates to kind of where we are culturally today and sort of some of the lessons learned. So this is a story that took place, what was it, in the 1930s?
Yes.
Okay. And Anne Cooper Hewitt was an heiress, but she was deemed to be feeble-minded. That was an actual mm-hmm. medical term at the time.
Yes.
Okay. So yes. Tell me a little bit about that.
So Anne was the daughter of Peter Cooper Hewitt, who was from the famous Cooper family in New York. So a very established, prominent family. Her father was an inventor. He invented a mercury vapor lamp and gained a sizable fortune from that. And he also inherited a lot of money from his father, Peter Cooper, who was considered by some to be the patriarch of New York City, who rubbed elbows with the Rockefellers and the Vanderbilts and had many prominent friends. And so Anne was born to him and a woman named Marion Cooper Hewitt. Now, she was a love child. Her father was already married when she was born, and they didn't marry until she was about 3 years old when he had divorced his other wife.
Okay. Had he had children with his other wife? Okay. So they were able to keep the scandal a little bit under wraps because of that.
Right.
Okay.
And probably the affair would have just continued. I believe Peter's wife knew about it. And it really wasn't until Anne came along that he and his wife decided, you know, there's no point in keeping this marriage going. And so they divorced and he quickly wed Anne's mother. And he died tragically when Anne was only 7. And her mother raised her. And as I talk about in the book, she had a very tragic and abusive childhood. Her mother always resented her, looked at her as an ugly duckling and a moron. And partly that was because Anne was a medically needy child. She had been born severely premature. And she was colicky. She had to wear a truss. And the mother sort of looked at her as this defective from the day she was born. And the mother was also somewhat of a partier. And people called her a gold digger. She was always trying to marry up. She had 5 husbands over the course of her life. Anne's father was husband number 3. And so she always looked at Anne as sort of cramping her lifestyle.
So Anne ended up being her only child?
She actually had a child from her first marriage as well, but he was so old that when Anne came along, he had kind of, you know, they never really had much of a relationship.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So when Anne was shortly before she turned 21, her mother, she was out to lunch with her mother one day, and she suddenly struck with stomach pains. And she has their chauffeur drive them back to San Francisco. And there's a doctor waiting there. And he just says, "Well, Anne, I understand you have appendicitis." And he doesn't even examine her abdomen. Instead, he takes her to another room. And there's a psychologist there. And she begins to pepper her with what are basically civics questions. So how long is the longest river in the United States? Why did the pilgrims come to America? Questions like that. And that's where Anne was deemed to be feeble-minded.
I see. So kind of an early, quote-unquote, intelligence test, an early cognitive capability test, but really I'm assuming one that didn't have very good norms, yeah, and one that probably wasn't very valid.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was when she was 20. So, okay, you know, yeah.
Yeah, it would have been like the 1950s at that time?
That would have been in 1934.
Oh, you're right. You're right. She was born. So 1930s is when all of this occurred. She was actually born right in the tens and the teens. Okay.
Yes. Gotcha, yes. Gotcha. Sorry about that.
No. That's helpful. So yeah, this was very early in the intelligence testing movement. And of course, as we know, I might have talked about on the show before, but definitely some of my own research has enlightened me about the intelligence testing movement early on was actually very much authored by eugenicists and very much had an agenda to prove the superiority of whites and to, and of course I say that in air quotes, and to kind of separate out people based on social class and other other defining factors. The intelligence testing movement early on definitely was written and developed with a very specific purpose in mind, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And so, you know, but this was a rich white woman. And so she was a little bit, I guess, captivating for individuals. So she goes into this dark room, she's peppered with these questions that she couldn't possibly know the answer to, whether she was was she educated?
She was educated. And okay. The reason why she didn't answer those questions, according to her court testimony later, is that she just thought that they were asinine. She didn't understand what was going on.
Right. She's like, "I have a pain in my abdomen. Why are you asking me about the longest river?"
Yeah. So she was educated mostly by governesses and by private tutors. And she would call upon a lot of those individuals later to prove that she wasn't feeble-minded, that in fact, you know, she had these highbrow literary tastes. She read Shakespeare and Dante and all of these people. So she definitely would appeal to her education and her class as a way of proving that she wasn't feeble-minded.
Interesting. So this kind of first judgment of, quote, feeble-mindedness came from a psychologist who, for whatever reason, was hired, I'm assuming by mom, but in conjunction with this physician who, it sounds like it was a ruse. "Oh, you don't feel well. Let's take you into this kind of dark room. Let's give you this, quote, psychological examination." She's like, "What are you doing? I'm not feeling well." And then what followed?
Yeah. So the physicians that the mother had hired, and there were two, one was the one who made the diagnosis that she had been feeble-minded and said that she should be sterilized. And then the other was the surgeon, the one who actually performed the procedure. And both of these figures were also told about Anne's supposedly riotous sex life. So this is another important component to the feeble-minded diagnosis. The mom says that Anne had been addicted to masturbation since she was 3 years old, and that she was a sex addict, that she had a preference for men in uniform, in other words, working class men. She said that she once caught Anne sitting on the lap of a, quote, Negro train porter. And that right there was enough to frighten authorities, because a woman who was perceived to be promiscuous was deemed likely to cross the color line. So even if Anne didn't have these proven heritable defects, she didn't have epilepsy or these other conditions, the very fact of her promiscuity was enough to concern eugenicists, because her mixing with other races was another way that people could pollute the supposed purity of the white race. So the mom says, you know, she flirts with all these working men, including African Americans. She says that Anne once tried to run away with the chauffeur, and that her mother, Marion, intercepted these love letters that contained her pubic hairs. And so the doctors were very easily persuaded that, yes, this woman was indeed feeble-minded, and for society's sake, as well as her own, she needed to be prevented from having children.
Wow. And so this really obviously speaks to the racial climate at the time, the kind of real, I guess, purpose of the eugenics movement, which, it's interesting. I remember watching a really in-depth, maybe it was an American Experience documentary on PBS.
Yes.
Yeah, it was like a multi-parter about the eugenics movement. And I learned a lot about the climate, the sort of social context of the eugenics movement at the time, that there was almost, and I hate to use this word, but there was almost an innocence to how it was presented and how the American people really took to the eugenics movement, that it didn't feel to them nefarious. It wasn't contextualized in that way. It was actually like for the social good. Oh, it wasn't like, you know, other races are bad. It didn't have like a Third Reich vibe to it. It very much had a, let's try and make sure that everybody has happy, healthy babies. Let's try and make sure that, you know, as human beings, that we're utilizing modern medicine to the best of our ability, not like, let's purify the bloodline, you know? And so that, it was interesting to me when I watched, because I remember thinking, how could so many people buy into this at the time? Like, was America, I mean, yes, America was that racist, and yes, America was that, focused. But at the same time, I remember thinking like, oh, even people who maybe weren't overtly white supremacists could have very easily bought this hook, line, and sinker, because it really was sold to them as a way to, you know, just be healthy, to lead a healthier life.
Yes. I agree with you. I think that that focus on health and eradicating disabilities was a much easier sell. And in fact, a lot of people still today think that the eugenics movement was primarily about eradicating disability. And, you know, to a certain extent, that's true. But if you think about why exactly disabled people were targeted, it comes back to race. So eugenics comes to rise in the United States at a time when there are very intense racial anxieties, when the demographics of the U.S. population are changing. So there's the Great Migration, which is the movement of African Americans from the rural South to the industrial North. There's also a lot of immigration from Eastern European countries. And so people were very afraid for the future of the white race. And they perceived a need to sort of shore up the strength and the vitality of their own race so that they could, you know, better prevail. And so, yes, they did target, you know, white people in the first few decades of the eugenics movement. It was poor whites, mentally ill whites, disabled, criminals, substance dependent people. But in many ways, those people were, those whites were collateral victims of white supremacy. People thought we need to purge the white trash from our own ranks. So just because whites were targeted often for their disabilities or their other socially undesirable characteristics, it was still very much about race.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting thinking about this kind of era, right? Just for context, I think a lot of us, we need to go back. The 30s was so long ago. This was, you know, almost 100 years ago now. Wow, gosh, that's crazy to think about. But this was, you know, decades before the peak of the civil rights movement. That's not to say there weren't civil rights workers, you know, civil rights activists working behind the scenes in the 30s, but this was decades before, like, you know, 1968 was sort of the flagship year that most of us think about when we lost MLK. A few years previous was when we lost Malcolm X. And so the 30s, we're talking segregation, deep segregation still. Like, yes, okay, slavery had been abolished, but this is mandated and, you know, government-sanctioned segregation throughout most of the U.S., although in the North, kind of there were their own, I guess, racial tensions. Segregation wasn't so overt, but the racial tensions were probably no less severe.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the North, there really developed fears of people who, quote, passed. So the light-skinned African-Americans who might look white enough to pass as white. And passing was thought to be an enabler of the kind of racial mixing that eugenicists were eager to prevent.
Wow. And of course, this takes us back to Anne. So it seems like the real kicker, the real linchpin, the thing that kind of pushed these physicians over the edge to say, yes, we absolutely need to sterilize this woman and take away, without her consent, her right to reproduce, is because mom is telling us that there's a real risk here that she could have sex with a black man and produce offspring.
Yes.
That's really what it came down to.
Yeah. I mean, they had the, you know, their little junk intelligence test, but I think it really did hinge on Anne's supposed sex crazedness and like you said, her likelihood of breeding with someone of another race.
Wow. Wow. And so at this time, you know, I'm interested, In your historical research, and of course, it's very hard to get into the mind of somebody of a different era and to try and really understand their own thought process. But was this sort of a collaboration between mom and the professional or the people in positions of power? Was there a little bit of influence from the people in positions of power to mom, or was mom really exerting that influence on those individuals to say, let's do this? Like, where did the kind of spark or the initiation come from?
I think it came from her mother. I think she hatched the plot. She did pay the doctors an extraordinary amount for the surgery. It was like several thousand dollars for something that back then should have been a few hundred. So that clearly raised authorities' suspicion. But also, the doctor who ordered the surgery was believed to be, according to the newspapers, one of mom's many lovers. So, you know, he already had a relationship with mom, had probably been hearing about how wild and riotous Anne was. So he was inclined to believe her and also to do a favor for her.
Right. And of course, that kind of shows that there's a kind of strange irony here, and that the thing that mom seems to have feared most about her daughter is kind of maybe a part of herself that she wasn't terribly proud of or that she hadn't faced. And that was her kind of promiscuity, which at the time in the 30s, there was a little bit of like a women's lib movement. There was a little bit of like kind of, yes, we're wearing the pants and yes, we have our rights, but at the same, and yes, we just got the vote recently. But at the same time, of course, sexism was like rampant still. Like, this was not solved overnight.
Yes. And eugenicists were very sophisticated and savvy about adapting their language and logic to the times. So at the turn of the century, which was probably before eugenicists had really, you know, reached its high watermark, but at that point, women's sexuality was still very feared. Then we have the 20s, liberation, the flappers, and all of that. And so eugenicists said, well, it's not sexualized women that are such a danger, it's over-sexualized women. And of course, they get to be the ones who define what an over-sexualized woman is.
Of course.
And so that word came up a lot in Anne's case, that she was oversexed.
Yeah, gotcha. Even though mom was, you know, really probably grappling with her own experiences as a woman who was very free and probably very liberated and sadly at a different time, you know, may have felt proud. But there probably was some real self-loathing in that. And as you mentioned, some almost like strange jealousy around her daughter. Because her daughter was an adult at this point, just barely, but she was an adult.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is another interesting component to this story. Because if she had been a child, I mean, gosh, that's not to say it would have been any better. I don't know if it would have been better, worse, or equally as abhorrent. But if she had been a child, mom probably would have had, I don't know, more legal rights to make medical decisions for her daughter. But because her daughter was an adult, that being deemed mentally feeble was very important, right?
Well, the surgery actually took place just a few months before Anne achieved majority. So shortly before her 21st birthday.
And, oh, 21 set off at the time.
Yes.
Oh,
and
okay.
So I believe that the mom, and I don't know if we've mentioned yet the detail about the mom claiming the inheritance.
No, we haven't talked at all about money.
Yeah. So the mother, well, the will from Anne's father, Peter Cooper Hewitt, stipulated that 2/3 of his estate, which was $4 million, estimated to be about $59 million by today's terms.
Okay, that's a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah. 2/3 goes to Anne, 1/3 goes to Marion. But if Anne dies childless, then the money reverts back to Marion. Now, that's a very unusual provision, and the will was changed a few weeks before his death, which is curious. And so Anne's story was that the mom was doing this to deprive her of the family money, and that it was just a few months before she became an adult and legal in the eyes of the law, at which point Marion would have no further say over her medical care.
Mm. Okay. Oh, that's so interesting. So that is a weird provision. Was that, I mean, was there some sort of social context that would explain why if she doesn't have any kids, she shouldn't get any of the money?
It was really curious to me. And from reading the newspaper accounts of the time, others seemed to think that it was an unusual provision as well.
Okay. So really, it sounds like what he was trying to do is ensure that his lineage was cared for, yet, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to like revert it back to his widow, should the daughter not have kids, because the daughter was still younger and had a longer life ahead of her.
Yeah, I think that he was so sickly that he was just being influenced by Marion towards the end of his life. It's kind of unclear what his ailments were. He had some abdominal issues, I think cancer, and he was just so debilitated in the last few months of his life that it's hard to think of him having full consent to whatever he signed.
Okay. And so this will is, you know, they both know what it says, I'm assuming. Did Anne know what it said?
I believe so.
Okay. All right.
She certainly did, you know, after her surgery, and she hired a lawyer. And
yeah.
I'm not sure exactly when she found out, but I had the impression that she knew all along.
Gotcha. And so, you know, she's deemed mentally unfit. She's deemed feeble-minded. And, you know, this transition between the physician having the psychologist present, you know, doing this kind of sneak attack, non-informed consent, because of course this is the 30s, so this is before Nuremberg, and this is before any sort of ethics boards, you know, so we didn't have a requirement for informed consent, at least not to the extent, the robust extent that we do today. So she, you know, she sits for this psychological exam that's kind of like sprung on her without her permission and is deemed obviously by a ruse to be mentally unfit. The transition between when this happens and when she has the surgery, like how did that go down?
So she, when she had been rushed back to San Francisco with stomach pains, and the doctor, of course, he doesn't examine her. She just gets the psychologist's test, and she's told to come back 4 days later for an appendectomy to have her appendix removed, which is very curious to anybody who knows about appendicitis because it's often a very acute condition, right? My husband had his appendix taken out. And it was like within hours, you have to get that thing out.
Yeah, emergency surgery. Yeah.
Right. So that was a curious detail. And so my hunch is that the mother did something to make her unwell, like put something in her drink to sort of set this plot in motion. So Anne does come back 4 days later, and she thinks she's getting her appendix removed. And indeed, she does have her appendix removed. But the surgeon also takes out her fallopian tubes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
do they tell her at the time?
No. So okay. It's while she's convalescing that she hears nurses talk about their, quote, idiot patient. And mm-hmm. they're talking about her as if she was a mental case. And she reflects back on, you know, things that her mother has said over the years, you know, for instance, that she would make a terrible mother. And she just kind of begins to piece things together and realizes with horror what her mother has done.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It's like there's a real bitter irony here that obviously you would think that one of the defining characteristics of somebody who is not, and again, not that this would justify this type of horrific surgery, but that one of the defining characteristics of somebody who has like severe cognitive deficits is that they wouldn't be able to self-reflect and to hear the nurses talk about her in such a way and say, they're talking about me and little mm-hmm. do they know, I understand everything they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh. That's heartbreaking.
I think it is very heartbreaking. And I think that Anne's cleverness was really demonstrated then when she brought this case against her mother. And the mother was clever herself in that she was framing Anne's feeble-mindedness as a sexual threat, right? She really leaned into that detail about the, quote, Negro train porter. And Anne did the same thing by saying, well, in not so many words, it's not me who is unfit for motherhood. It's my mother. Look at what a bad mother she is. She's a partier. She squandered my inheritance my whole life. She's the one that has this addiction to men in uniform. And so she too was sort of exploiting these cultural anxieties that existed. And of course, this just made for, you know, great tabloid and news coverage. This was like Jerry Springer for the 1930s. People just ate it up.
Yeah. And that's really like why this story, or not why, but this story did really capture the imagination. This was not, it's interesting that you mentioned at the very beginning that you were quite surprised that there was no kind of book length historical record of this, that there was no like intense documentary that you found or anything like that, like good scholarship on this, because this was, it's not like there's not news clippings. It's not like this wasn't everywhere at the time. It was the Kardashians of the era. Like people were obsessed.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting to me that the New York Times covered this case about 50 times in 1936. And it received so much more coverage than Buck v. Bell, which was the sterilization case involving a Virginia woman that went all the way to the Supreme Court. I think I may have read that the New York Times only did one story on that case that year. And so the coverage of Anne's case was so extensive, it's just splashed all over the newspapers. And Carrie Buck's case got little coverage. But today, if people know of a sterilization case, it's Carrie Buck's case, and nobody has heard of Ann Cooper Hewitt.
Isn't that funny that there's kind of the momentary fascination and obsession with the things that are very, very splashy and maybe just lend themselves better to media coverage because the individuals involved are willing to sit for interviews because they like to have their photographs taken, because there's a lot of people who want to sit and talk about this stuff. And because, of course, it captures the imagination in a like kind of grotesque, obsessive way. Whereas, of course, the experience or the, I guess the experience, yeah, that actually affects the historical record is the one that ends up being most salient historically, right? The one that actually set precedent is going to be the one that we are going to cite later on.
Right. Yeah. I think at the time, it was also Carrie Buck's poverty that made people uninterested in her.
Right.
People tend not to be bothered about what's happening behind the closed doors of an asylum if they know that it involves people who they perceive to be defective or, you know, waste humanity. But with Anne, I think that it also, beyond interesting people, maybe made them a little scared to think, well, you know, if this could happen to this wealthy white heiress, could it happen to anyone?
Right. There's almost like a moral outrage in the same way that you see now where the story of a little beautiful white girl who's, for example, goes missing or is murdered by her parents or is, you know, whatever the case may be, gets so much more media attention than the story, sadly, of a young black girl or a child who's in poverty. We may not even hear those stories, but I think there's a certain level of course, racially motivated moral outrage, because you're right, it taps into a carnal fear in people in positions of power. They say, if that could happen to that child, it could happen to my child. Or if that could happen to her, it could happen to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Yikes. And so, of course, you know, up to this point, we've kind of told the story of her first getting sterilized and then finding out while she's convalescing. But then the legal battles begin, because she is, of course, not so mentally defective as to not be able to hire her own counsel and to, you know, put together a massive legal defense and say, this should not have happened to me. Like, she, not just that there was an assault on her personally, but there was an understanding, there was a real fundamental appreciation that this was not morally justified, that her rights were taken from her. She had the right to make children if she decides she wants to. And that was taken from her without her consent, which is at the heart of the eugenics movement, right? Forced sterilization is, you know, it's the sort of more polite step prior to genocide. This is how you prevent people from continuing their, quote, bloodline.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And the legal stuff began with a civil suit that she filed. So in January of 1936, she, with her attorney, files a lawsuit against her mother and the doctors, and she asks for $500,000 from her mother. And that civil suit was quickly piggybacked with criminal charges. So the San Francisco prosecutor just sees this case as, you know, catapulting his career. And so he files what were called criminal mayhem charges against Anne's mother and the two doctors and the psychologist. And there was a hearing, and the psychologist was quickly dropped from the case. The judge felt that, you know, while she had some culpability, she shouldn't be included in these criminal mayhem charges. And so Anne's mother flees for the East Coast. She files an affidavit in her defense, but before authorities can knock on the door of her penthouse, she's already boarded a train for New Jersey. And she actually never returned to California. She was over on the East Coast where when the case started to heat up and opinion was really beginning to turn against her and she feared a court judgment, she tried to kill herself. And so she was in a hospital in New Jersey. And even after her suicide attempt, she kept getting her physician to say, you know, she's unwell, she can't be extradited. And so what happens is California authorities then decide that they're just going to proceed with the trial against the two doctors. And what really, so they bring that trial in August, but prior to bringing the trial, they begin to consult with eugenicists in California. And there was a man named Paul Popino who ran the Human Betterment Foundation in California.
What a name. Wow. Yeah. And that really does speak back to what we were just talking about, this kind of campaign for, health and wellness, quote unquote.
Right. It's such a soft, seemingly innocuous name. And so he has a really interesting history. He had really crusaded to expand sterilization laws in California and also around the U.S. So in a lot of states, sterilization laws had been enacted, but authorities there were afraid to exercise those laws. And so Paul Popino would write them letters and try to assuage their worries and say, you know, sterilization is no more difficult or worse than pulling a tooth. You know, it's just no big deal at all. And so he was corresponding with people in other states, and he was corresponding with German officials. And there were several high-ranking officials who later became involved with the Third Reich who credited Popino specifically for helping to ignite their movement in Germany.
Wow. And of course, that's something that I want to turn to in a minute, that we really can't tell this story without telling the story of the of Hitler's intentions for the final solution, because ultimately this is directly linked. And that's something that I think a lot of people don't realize, is that the Nazi eugenics movement was really, the fire was lit beneath it here in America. Like the mm-hmm. eugenics movement really kind of started here
mm-hmm.
and then yeah. was influenced a lot of Hitler's policies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was our sterilization laws, but also our Jim Crow laws that really attracted them. And so even in the 1930s, before the world witnesses, you know, the full horror of what the Nazis executed, Germans were taking action to establish their own versions of these programs. So they had passed laws which authorized the sterilization of certain children and disabled people. They had passed laws which forbade marriage with Jews and between Jews and non-Jews. So by the time Anne's case came along, Americans were actually already beginning to develop a distaste for what was happening in Germany without really realizing what was going on at home.
Right. Because it was sort of, I don't know, it was sanitized at home. It felt different. And of course, this apartheid state, this Jim Crow state, was the norm. And so it probably didn't, sadly, except for the people who were horrifically affected by it, which was, Black people in our country, to sort of rich whites, this idea probably didn't strike them because it was just the way you live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that a lot of what was happening in asylums, which is where these sterilizations were taking place, that's another curious detail about Anne's case, is that it had happened in private practice and the court wasn't really sure what to do with that. So the laws that had been passed had authorized sterilization in state institutions where a director had declared somebody to be feeble-minded. And because it's happening behind those closed doors, a lot of people just didn't know, you know, that tens of thousands of Americans had been sterilized. And it really wasn't polite conversation. So it was just sort of out of sight, out of mind. And it, in many cases, wasn't until Anne's case came along that people even realized that these numbers of people were being operated upon.
And so, you know, this Anne's story specifically captured people's imaginations for some of the reasons that we talked about. Obviously, it became like the gossip of the town. It became front page news. People were just eating this up. It was kind of like the reality television programming of its time. But the question I guess I have is, what were the, was it mixed reactions? Did this raise awareness about the negative consequences of the eugenics movement, or was it sort of status quo? And people were like, yeah, this is crazy, but I agree with it. Like, where were people's moral judgments lying at the time? Were they all over the place?
Yeah. Well, I think it was the hardest to understand how ordinary Americans felt, because they did not get the chance to have their views printed in newspapers. But what I did find was that in the immediate days after the criminal case was filed, so this is in January of 1936, the San Francisco Examiner published this little forum where these community leaders offered their views. So they had like a prominent Jewish leader and a Catholic and, you know, people from different faiths and traditions. And the opinion was pretty split on whether or not Anne's sterilization was lawful as well as moral. But as the case went on over the year, and by the time that the trial took place in August of that year, I think that the opinion had really turned against her. And I believe that's because of the mother persuading people that she really was a sex maniac and she was a danger to society in that way. I think that when Americans had anxiety about Germany and what they were seeing there, is that they seemed to see the Germans doing things to an entire class of people, right? And in their minds, Anne's sterilization was different. It wasn't because she was a certain race or even that she had inherited any physical disability, but that she was misbehaved. She was unruly. And those criteria for many people were sufficient.
Right. So in their minds, she deserved it. She had it coming. And of course, it just goes to show that legal proceedings, that, you know, these types of life-altering judgments don't happen in a vacuum. They are a product of their time. And it's so easy to tap into the fears of the general public, especially when it comes to moral outrage. I mean, it's funny that in my mind I'm linking this story specifically to the kind of satanic panic of the 1980s and the stories that we hear about young boys being sentenced, or even, you know, the Central Park Five, or like all of these very specific stories where we see these young boys being sentenced to horrific punishments simply because you're able to tap into a cultural panic around religion or around race or around, you know, sex. These kind of puritanical and supremacist values are so easily manipulated. And sadly, there are always victims of this social movement. There are always people who are harmed because of it.
Yeah. I think that that's so interesting that you raise that example. Writing this book has really exposed to me how much homophobia, just like ableism, is ultimately rooted in white supremacy. So a lot of the language that is deployed against gays and trans people today reflects the very same racial anxieties that we saw during eugenics. So eugenicists didn't like gays for a few reasons. Number one, they thought of them as emasculating the race. So we talked earlier about, you know, they wanted to strengthen the white race and make it more virile. And gays, just like disabled people, were perceived to be undermining that effort. And the other thing is just that gay people are not reproducing the white race. And those kind of, that logic still persists today. There was a prominent evangelist who, right after 9/11, blames it on gays. And he said that homosexuals were, quote, softening the nation up for Islam. So the danger of gays to this figure is that they are undermining the white Christian nation.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it is interesting too how much white supremacy is really rooted in religion, or I mean, it's hard to say if it's rooted in religion or religion has served as sort of a vehicle for white supremacy, you know, the chicken and egg situation, but there's really an inextricable link there between white supremacy and Christian supremacy, and that these vehicles have served this movement since, you know, as far as American history existed, mm-hmm. really. And not just here in our country, but we've exported that around the world. You see that with, you know, documentaries and stories like in God Loves Uganda about, it's a great documentary I highly recommend, about the anti-gay movement in Uganda, which was basically just exported there from white evangelicals here. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. Roads lead back to sort of Southern white evangelical movements to kind of keep the race pure.
And a really fun fact, James Dobson, who is, you know, considered one of the, you know, grandfathers of the modern evangelical movement, got his start working for Paul Popenoe in California.
Right back to this man who apparently was very powerful. And how did he maintain, or how did he kind of amass that sort of political sway? Was he especially charming? Was he like, did he have some sort of je ne sais quoi that people really like, did he command a room?
Popenoe?
Yeah.
I don't know. I've seen, yeah, that's a really good question. His only degree, his PhD, was an honorary one. So he didn't even have an academic background.
And it's hard for me to not assume that he was born of privilege.
Yes.
And that he, you know, was kind of, it's that, I go back to that like Obama quote that, you know, that like, he didn't earn that. You didn't earn that.
You didn't build that.
You didn't build that. Exactly. Like you just kind of were, gifted this position and you took it with fervor. And of course, I think, you know, Popenoe, like you said, sort of directly influencing kind of important movers and shakers in the Third Reich, and this kind of exporting of the American eugenics movement to the, you know, the Nazi movement. I think, and that's not to say that it wasn't brewing in Germany already, but it was formalized in America. It was structuralized in America in such a way that, that Germany was able to look to these American structures and say, look how they did that. That's something that impresses me that I want to sort of take to the next level, right? I mean, would you say that that's kind of a good characterization?
Yeah, I would. Popenoe received, numerous letters from figures over there in which they were thanking him for his work. And I've also read that at the Nuremberg trials, part of the defense that Nazis offered was, well, we got our blueprints from the U.S. So just pointing the figure back to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, I know that these obviously supremacist values persist. We know this, and we saw a resurgence during the Trump administration. And that's not a resurgence of something that was lying dormant. It was always there. But it was like able to be codified and brought out into the light, right? Because there were dog whistles being blown. And, you know, we know that this kind of cultural movement at times lays dormant, at times is outspoken, but is always kind of persisting. There's a really good Frontline. I think the most recent Frontline documentary that just came out is about the rise of the neo-Nazi movement back in Germany and sort of the strictures around it and the lack of sort of policing around it in the community. Obviously, we know that these kind of right-wing fundamentalist values exist throughout the world. But I guess the question is, like, what changed? You know, Germany, obviously, or I should say World War II, obviously shone a specific light, not just on what was going on, you know, in the European campaign, but also, did it shine a light on ourselves? Were we able to self-reflect at all and say we're moving in the wrong direction? Like, looking back, you know, with hindsight, how would you say that the Nazis actually affected our own eugenics movement here at home?
I think that they only pushed us to find new forms for eugenics.
Right. So kind of affected what we think of as polite and out in the open.
Right. And one of those, one of the ways that eugenics shape-shifted after the war was by focusing not on negative eugenics, which is sterilizing the unfit and seeing that those kinds of people don't reproduce, to positive eugenics, which is getting the right people to reproduce. And the right people, the fit people, are able-bodied middle-class whites. And that's actually the turn that Popenoe took after Anne's case, is that he just switched to the other side of the coin. He opens up a new institute, and this one is called the American Institute of Family Relations. And it sounds very, you know, swell, except it's all about getting white women to reproduce by removing any kind of barriers to like marital conflict. So that included couples counseling and all those people that had made intelligence tests in the past just begin to make these marital compatibility tests for white people. And so couples counseling, making sure people are compatible, which was often a code for the same race. So, you know, if you were, you know, white and you were interested in a black person, you were not compatible, and they would try to discourage that marriage. And trying to eliminate things like pornography within marriage or masturbation or anything that they saw as presenting a conflict between a man and a wife. And that's how that Dobson became very involved. You know, he talks a lot about family values. That's a big term in evangelical culture. He gained that from Popenoe and from the eugenics movement.
Wow. And so, you know, here kind of at the close of the hour, I've got some other questions that I want to ask you that I ask all my guests right at the very end. But before we get to that portion of the show, I'd love to know what happens of Anne. You know, how does her story play out? And did people care at that point?
So the judge in the case ended up dismissing the criminal charges against the two doctors before it could even go to a jury. And that's because he didn't believe that a crime had been committed. And after that, she still had the opportunity to see her mother be tried, but she decided that she was not going to testify against her mother after all. And I believe that that was because, she and her mother, in this really weird, strange way, had bonded over the last year, even though they were on opposite sides of the coast, in that they both received a kind of thrashing by the media. They had both been on trial as unfit mothers. And in a weird way, they kind of understood each other at a level that they hadn't before. And I think also that Anne felt sorry about her mother's suicide attempt, and she didn't want to be the reason why her mother tried again and was successful this time. And so, much to the anger of the prosecutors, she said that she wasn't going to testify. She then married, and interestingly, just like her mother, had five husbands.
Oh, wow.
Yes. For different reasons. I think her mother was always trying to improve her social station, and Anne was really after love, and she was somewhat of a lost soul, and she would have hope that a relationship was going to work out, but the person was using her, you know, either because of her money or her fame and notoriety, and that so she was always in pursuit of love, whereas Marian was marrying for money and these other things.
And of course, they didn't lose their fortunes through this, did they?
No. So Marian died about 3 years after the case. She died of a stroke in New York. She had actually called Anne about a week before her death saying that she wanted to reconcile. And Anne didn't know what to do with that. So she didn't call her back. And then when her mother died, she experienced such remorse. She traveled to New York to bury her. She was photographed weeping at her mother's graveside. And the newspapers, and I interpret that as her forgiving her mother. But she didn't lose the money. She had the money. Her husbands, many of them, were after it. And so she kind of, you know, never really achieved that happiness. It was very tragic.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a tragic story at a personal level. It's a tragic story at a cultural and societal level. It's a tragic story in that we probably didn't learn very much from it. Hopefully, you know, some of the right people did, and it really did help some activists see something that was quite hidden, as you mentioned, and quite buried within the asylum systems. It brought out to light some of, you know, the risk of the eugenics movement. But at the same time, it did, and in many ways, as you mentioned, become historically buried. Like, most people have not heard of this story, and this is their first time to, I mean, definitely that was the case for me when your book came across my desk. This is the first time to ever be thinking about this specific story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm really glad that I got to tell it. And I should have mentioned earlier the book of Wendy Klein, who was where I encountered Anne's story. She wrote an academic book about the eugenics movement. It's called Building a Better Race, and she had a chapter on Anne. So I'm very grateful to her for the scholarship that she did that drew me to this story in order to be able to tell it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, it's obviously so important that there have been individuals working on these important kind of social problems academically. But of course, it's also very important that the general public become aware that these things, again, just like where the asylum sterilizations were sort of happening behind closed doors, that this thick dividing line between academia and society, become thinner. And I think that's obviously what we try to do on this show with Science Communication. That's what you tried to do by writing a popular book about something that, you know, has historically, it was popular at the time, but then of course it fell into these sort of more academic circles. And so it's so important that this story is being told. Audrey, you know, I was hoping that before we go, that I could ask you the same two questions that I ask all of my guests on the show. And of course, here on Talk Nerdy, I interview mostly scientists and science writers. And your story was so important because it does tap into some of those important God, I just said the word important like three times. It does tap into some of those meaningful takeaways that still touch on these kind of scientific constructs. Anyway, that's all just to say that I'm interested in how you answer these questions, because individuals from all walks of life have been posed these questions in the past. So they're sort of big picture, kind of broad. Are you ready for them? Okay. So when you think about the future in whatever context is, of course, relevant to you right now, you kind of are holding the reins with that. Number one, I want to know, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night? So this could be personal, professional, social, cultural, national, global, cosmic, you know, whatever the context is. What is the thing that's keeping you up the most at night, thing you're most concerned about, maybe pessimistic, maybe even cynical about? And then on the flip side of that, to end on a more positive note, what are you genuinely, authentically hopeful for? What are you looking forward to? Where does your optimism lie?
Mm-hmm. So my answer to both of those questions is connected. What keeps me up at night? I think about a question that Dr. King was asked towards the end of his life. He was asked what he perceived to be one of the mistakes that he'd made in his movement. And he said that he had overestimated the moral integrity of white Christians. And I am seeing what's happening in the news and even in my family, people that I love, and seeing how the lengths that they are willing to go to, which include undermining democratic norms and suppressing the teaching of history in public schools, all to preserve some kind of power or idea of their heritage, or, you know, there are many different reasons. And that really concerns me. But
you know, before you go to your butt, it triggers in me this. I'm remembering back to when I had Elaine Weiss on the show to talk about her book, The Woman's Hour, about the women's suffrage movement here in the United States, and specifically that this really, you cannot talk about that story without talking about race. And I remember, you know, how, what a wonderful job she did to open my eyes to the idea that sort of, you know, this women's movement was all good and well, and it was very unified up until there was a concern that Black women might derail it, or there was a concern that, you know, maybe people wouldn't catch on if they saw Black women out in front. And so there were all of these, like, it was not monolithic, and it was in many ways crumbled at the hands of white women who were torn between saying, you know, the vote for all women, and saying, but maybe not you guys yet. Maybe you guys are this is a concern for me. And it just kind of speaks to exactly what you're talking about. This, like, I remember the letter from a Birmingham jail when Dr. King wrote about how it's not the Klanner, it's not the citizens counselor, it's the white moderate. The white moderate who just sits there and goes, I don't really want to ruffle any feathers or change the status quo. That's what's really preventing progress. The extremists, we know they're there and we can fight them head on. But if the bulk of the people who should have moral outrage are like, meh, but my position is too comfortable, it's why it's not enough to be not racist. You have to be anti-racist. And yeah, it's like, oh, this just... What an important point you just made, and I just wanted to kind of reinforce it and link it to some things that were happening in my mind.
Yeah, and on that note, you know, a lot of these bills that are cropping up in state legislatures about what's allowed to be taught in schools say that you're not allowed to cause mental anguish of students. So white comfort is setting the limits of our engagement with history.
It's insane.
Yeah. What I'm hopeful about is the religious left. And I say that as somebody who is not religious, even though I grew up religious, but as a historian who is kind of seeing what I perceive to be a swelling, a movement building. We have figures like Raphael Warnock and AOC and Cori Bush who are talking about their faith in the public square in a way that really excites me as a non-religious person, because I think that they have the tools and the means to sort of to call out a lot of the hypocrisy on the religious right, and to also bring a kind of energy and hope and idealism to politics, to progressivism that, you know, we all need.
Yeah. Yeah. Ugh. Audrey, thank you so much for your time today. I think that this conversation had so many layers, and my hope is that individuals who are listening today continue to think about these difficult topics, and that we sort of are able to apply this very specific story that captured the imagination of individuals in the 1930s to how we live our lives today, what has changed and what really hasn't, and think sort of anew about how much more we have to go. So thank you so much for taking the time, for writing the book, first of all. Everybody, the book is The Unfit Heiress, The Tragic Life and Scandalous Sterilization of Anne Cooper Hewitt. Audrey, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.